I've had students in the elevators in some of the skyscrapers of downtown Toronto, and the students get on the elevator and they stand on a bathroom scale and they go up and down the elevator and they watch how their weight changes.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Ron Lancaster. I live in Hamilton, mathematics teacher for many years, from grade 7 through to the end of high school, and I'm currently working as an independent math consultant.
So MathWalks, what is it?
You know, basically it's an opportunity for kids to get out of the classroom and to be a bit more active in the learning and to, you know, apply the mathematics to things around them instead of just being within the walls of the classroom. I did some work with TV Ontario. I did a bunch of television shows for them, and a lot of them were shot right in the city of Toronto. Some of them were done up at Kelso Conservation Area. Some of these math shows were filmed in the middle of a boat sitting in the lake at Kelso Conservation Area. And I must say that when I was out doing these shows, one thing that haunted me a lot is, why are my students not here? I was teaching at an all-girls school in Oakville called St. Mildred's. And I was teaching from grade 7 through to the end of high school. I started to think about having the kids go outside of the classroom and do mathematics in a place outside of the room. I mean, I've always been one to use a lot of things in my room related to mathematics. But to go outside of the room was something new for me. So I began by having the kids in the parking lot of the school at St. Mildred's, where they did some mathematics in the parking lot. It worked out really well. The kids enjoyed being out there. Eventually, it spawned into me taking a group of grade 8s one year down into downtown Oakville. We went for a walk, went down there, and went into a few of the stores and looked around and did some mathematics. And then I thought, you know, this really is a really wonderful way for kids to learn math. And then that eventually led to going to Toronto on much larger walks where they were very well planned out, a guided walk with just tons of mathematics questions all along the route. That's where it began. There's a conference I've gone to for a number of years in New Hampshire at Phillips Exeter Academy, and I started to do some math walks there for teachers with a dear friend of mine, Vince DeLisi. He taught outside of Toronto. And so we started doing some math walks together, and that eventually gave me some ideas about how to do this. What works, what doesn't work, which is a little bit safer doing it that way, you know, because teachers are, they're not going to get into trouble in the middle of somewhere. Whereas if you have kids in downtown Toronto and very young kids and things are not working out very well and it's all a mess, I mean, there's potential for some, you know, big problems. The very first trail was in April. It was a cold day. It was snowy. It was blustery. It was a terrible day. I'm in the middle of Toronto in the financial district. I've got kids outside, and I'm walking around watching them measuring stuff, doing things outside in the cold. And I really realized that this was a wonderful idea. If the kids were willing to be out in the middle of very cold weather, they were very engaged by these questions. This must be something special I need to really follow to do that. That particular trail, I heard rumors during the day that there was a mom who had abandoned the trail because of the cold weather. She had a little baby with her. The baby was in a stroller. And I'd heard these rumors that this mom had just said, like, the heck with it. We're getting out of here. And she took them all to the Eden Center. And, you know, my first reaction was, oh, no, the whole thing is going to unravel. People are going to abandon it and all of this. Turned out what this mom did was amazing. She went to the Eden Center. She quickly read through my trail questions. She didn't really feel that she was very good at math, ironically. I thought she was very good. But she looked at my questions and said, you know, we can do a lot of these in the Eden Center. So why don't we do them here where it's warm? So she did all these questions with the kids. She worked in stuff. It was amazing. And eventually, you know, I did a major trail in the Eden Center, you know, because of what she had done. It was fantastic. I'd have to say that it has been wildly successful. Like, the students have really reacted well to it over the years. Part of the success, like, I've now done workshops for other teachers all over the place throughout North America and Asia. And I think part of the success really depends on what teachers do with it. I think that that's taken me some time to figure out what's good follow-up to do, what are ways of enhancing the day. But the whole novelty of being outside of the classroom, whether it's in a shopping mall or in the skyscrapers of a city or on a farm or an art gallery, the campus of a school. I mean, just that whole notion of being out of the classroom doing mathematics has just that in itself has helped make it successful, the novelty, the unusual nature. I think for me also one thing that's helped is the type of questions that I've used. I've tried to get away from just kind of a standard textbook question. You know, I've tried not to just do those kind of questions in another setting. I've tried to add twists to them. I've tried to kind of add unusual things to the questions that kind of pique students' interest. One quick example I can give you is I've had students in the elevators in some of the skyscrapers of downtown Toronto, and the students get on the elevator and they stand on a bathroom scale and they go up and down the elevator and they watch how their weight changes. What happens as you go up when you look down at the scale? When the elevator stops, what happens? What happens when you go down? Can you make a graph of this? It turns out you can find the speed of an elevator from these observations. And that kind of question would be difficult to do in a classroom. I mean, you could talk about it in a classroom, but actually doing it and being able to do it surrounded by people is really cool. I just had students from a school in Toronto on one of my math trails in Toronto last week. And I told the students in advance, when they were in an office building at 1 Adelaide Street. And I said, when you go into the elevator, standing in a bathroom scale, so you're going to get two reactions, and it's going to be fun. You'll get people who will walk into the elevator, and they will look up at the numbers, and they'll just stare at the numbers, and they won't even say a word. But you will get other people who will get on, and they're going to look at you standing on this bathroom scale and say, what are you doing? What is this about? What's the purpose of this question? And that happened. The kids did, in fact, get people who got engaged in it as well, and they want to get on the scale as well, you know, to see what would happen. Like, it's the kind of thing that's intriguing, and that's the sort of thing that I've tried to develop into the questions. A lot of curiosity, being observant, being interested in things. Like, when I develop the questions, I tend to walk around a lot, and I tend to be really curious about stuff, and I ask questions, and I think about things. And so the novelty of the questions, I think, really helps as well. Yeah, I think it would really be tough for me to ever find any trail that will have better memories and a better feeling than the ones that I've done for my own students in Toronto. With these students from St. Mildred. You know, for me, it's where it began, and that reaction of the students, and it was just very, very special. Since then, I've done a lot of trails with students, but they've been where I've gone to a school, and I've developed a trail, and I have the students for a day. And I have great memories of those. I've really enjoyed them. But that's not quite the same feeling as my own class that I've got for the whole year. And I can do the follow-up, and I can work on things and integrate it into the courses. I've been in Singapore a lot, and I've taken actually now over 7,000 kids on trails. I've done about 70 trails there with 100 kids a day. And I have wonderful memories there because the curriculum in Singapore tends to be fairly traditional, fairly conservative. They're moving, they're attempting to move in a direction that's more creative, more open-ended questions. So my trails have really given those teachers an opportunity to see how one might teach, you know, within that framework. What does it mean to teach mathematics in a more creative way, in a more innovative way? And it's been wonderful doing it with the kids, because it has just been such a different experience for these kids. They just have never, you know, done anything that's remotely close to it. So, you know, that I have good memories of that. Those are my favorites as well.
You are listening to Radio Free School.
I've done them in a lot of different settings. Vince DeLisi and I, around Exeter, New Hampshire, we've done it in a chocolate store and a candy store. We've done it in a toy store. I've done it at conferences all over the place where I've been in hotels. It's mostly been cities and urban places. I have done some parks, though. In Singapore, I have a very large trail in Fort Canning Park. And that particular trail has a lot of connections to nature. I've helped teachers with math trails out connected to nature walks. But I haven't done a lot of that myself. I think part of it is that a lot of my questions tend to deal with, you know, designs and things that are geometrical, patterns. But, you know, come to think of it, a lot of that could easily be done with nature walks when you look at leaves and all of that. So it's something I really need to branch out into as well. I'm earning my living right now from working as an independent consultant. In Singapore, there are some private contractors in that country. And what they do is they bring workshop people like myself, that conduct workshops. So they contract with the schools. The schools pay a certain fee for having me come in, and then I get paid some money from that. So I've had things like that. I've done work at international schools, particularly over in Asia, where I go in there and I... usually what happens there is I'm brought into the school to do a lot more than a math walk. In March of this year, I'm going to be at the International School in Taiwan, and I'm doing some work with staff there. I'll be doing things on, you know, dealing with technology, ways of teaching, this and that, and math walks will be part of that. I've also had a couple places where I've been commissioned by an organization. The National Gallery in Ottawa hired me to come up, and I actually designed one for the art museum. And it's a walk through the museum, math questions based on the architecture of the building, some of the artwork, various things there. And I went up to Ottawa several times and actually trained the educational guides to do the tour. And the trail's now been turned over to them, and, you know, they run the trail. And I'd say these educational guides have made the trail much better than what I had put together initially. Because I did the thing from a mathematical perspective. They've added their immense knowledge about art to the trail. So there's been a blend, you know, there that's been happened. Sometimes I will get parents saying to me, oh, I get it. You're trying to give students a sense for the practical side of mathematics. So that's certainly one of the goals, is to show students areas where mathematics is used. So that's part of it. But I'd say a bigger part of it really is having kids become better thinkers because of the kind of questions that I give them. It's more of an intellectual experience than it is about the practical side of mathematics. I mean, the practical side's certainly there, but a lot of it is just dealing with that intellectual experience, being a better thinker. I try to design questions that promote being more curious, being more observant, being a bit off the wall. History teachers have been doing this for decades. So that's something that's very much, I'd say, very standard. In fact, when I first started to plan one of these trails, I was in Union Station. This is back in about 1995, and there was a history teacher there taking students on a history walk in Toronto. And I spoke with him, and he says, oh, I've been doing this for a long time. What a great city to have kids walk around in and learn history. And he thought it was really interesting that I was attempting to do the same thing from a mathematical perspective. So I'd say in history there's a lot of this. There have been some science walks that I've seen. I've actually taught some week-long courses on math trails for teachers, where I've had the teachers for a week and I've taught them how to design these. One year I actually had science and math teachers, both. And I attempted to you know, turned it into a bit of a science walk. I'd say for a number of reasons, it turned out to be a disaster. My science background is very poor. But I'd say there is certainly some work being done with science teachers as well.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFM.
I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 97.9 FM. In Fredericton, New Brunswick.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine?
There's kind of a number of things that you can do out here, but even on this street corner, one of the interesting things that you could do here is ask young children or students how many openings there are on this. The obvious thing that these young people could do is just to count them. Just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So once you get your 10, you can say, well, I don't have to count them anymore because I know that this is 10 as well. Do you see any other way of quickly counting how many openings there are?
Five, ten.
Oh, now that's nice. Right? That's
really, ten.
Yeah. That's really nice what she's observed, that you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and realize that, well, wait a minute, the other part's the same. So it's 10, as she said.
And then count by five.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or by 10,
15, 20.
That's a more creative way of figuring out the total. You know, the average person would just count them one by one, and that's kind of boring. It's more interesting to clump things together. I think another really nice question with this grate is, what would happen if they made these slots, this area here, smaller? Would that be a better thing? Or have they got the best? Like, do you see any problems if you made it smaller?
The opening smaller?
Yeah.
The water would have more trouble going through, and same with ice.
Well, that's beautiful. Yeah, absolutely. So somebody, I think anyway, has actually thought about these issues. What is the best design? And as you pointed out, if you made it smaller, and you said the same thing, that the water would have trouble getting through. So why not make it bigger then? Like, what's the problem there?
Because someone could fall through.
Oh, very good, yeah. Or you could take keys and accidentally drop them, and now you're in trouble. So stuff could fall through. We could ask the same question about the telephone poles and the hydro poles. That must cost a lot of money to put those poles up.
Why not just do it underground?
Oh, why not do it underground? Absolutely.
You just gotta dig a little pit and run it down.
Sure.
Instead of putting up these $100 poles, going up there, wiring the whole thing, and then have to fall down in the storm, and the transformers blow up in a lightning.
Yeah. So, one wonders why 50 years ago didn't they put them underground? What were the reasons? Maybe they didn't think about it, but maybe there's some other reasons that we maybe don't know the answer to. Why not put the poles
underground with poisons and things?
So there might be problems that way underground?
Yeah.
What happens if you want to repair the lines?
Just go right under.
Oh, so then you have to dig. So you'd have to dig to get to the wires. Ah, so maybe that might be a problem. Maybe that's why they didn't do it, because it's so costly to dig. You have to dig up the street just to, you know, repair a wire. Whereas here you just climb up and...
Or maybe just little short wires just on the surface.
That's a thought, yeah. I wonder if that might cause trouble though, where...
Electrocution.
Yeah, yeah. Why not make the poles further apart? Like, I think the city could have saved a lot of money if they would have made them further apart. Why not do that? Do you see any reasons? Why not make those poles twice as far apart, and then you don't need as many poles? Why didn't they do that?
I don't know.
Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. Maybe because it's not as able to catch together because the wire isn't long enough.
Yeah, I could give you more wire. That's good comment you made. But I could give you more wire. So you had enough
can't
wire.
Yeah, together, really, because that could come undone.
Oh, you know something? She's very close. If you,
I know.
What?
Well, I think I know.
Sure.
It would droop too much. That would be dangerous overhead wire.
Very nice. The wire would be twice as long, and it would be heavier.
You're right.
Right? So it might collapse. Because,
and
yes?
It could kill people.
Yeah.
It could electrocute them.
Sure.
And also, it would step the voltage down.
Oh, very nice, because it's a longer wire.
Right.
Yeah. You know, what's really neat about this is that you can stand in the street corner, and you can look around, and you can ask questions like that. You know, about things. Why they did certain things the way they did in there, which is really beautiful.
Why did they use these instead of painting them on the road?
We started the math walk right here.
One of the questions I've done with students standing here in an area too is just to spend a moment looking around at shapes and just trying to find as many shapes as you can in an area. And just seeing how people have actually used geometry and shapes to make things more beautiful. Like that house across the street with the circle. I'm sure whoever built that house found putting that circle in the middle to be a bit of a pain. You know, it would have been a lot easier to have just built that house and kept the wall going of bricks. But instead they had to stop and start putting bricks in at angles and moving them around. But somebody obviously felt that having that beautiful circle in the middle was important. That it made the house different from everything else. And it's nice how people have chosen to use shapes to beautify the world around us. Shapes are also used too so that you recognize things, like the stop sign. If stop signs were every shape imaginable, one was a pentagon and another one had 15 sides and another one was blue, it was red, it was green, the consistency could cause problems, you know, but having the same uniform shape helps people identify it more quickly. I'm not sure why they picked the octagon. Why eight sides instead of a rectangle, you know, or a square? A really good question for people this age as well would be to stand down there at the stop sign and to actually watch the orange light and to think about how long, like you could use a watch, how long is it orange for? Is it too short or is it too long? You know, and not long enough, you know. Do you know why they have a yellow light? Why?
It means slow, you can pass, but it's going to turn red soon.
Oh, good for you. So it's a warning.
It would be too sudden.
Good for you. So if you made the orange light 10 seconds long, would that be better or worse?
A little bit better and a little bit worse.
Worse in what sense?
People couldn't get there fast enough.
Warning. Okay. Yep. Another thing you might want to do sometime at a corner is actually stand there and have the students count how many cars go into the intersection when it's red. Uh-huh. And do a ratio. Like, do all cars stop when it's red?
No.
Or do some cars actually still go through?
Yes, they do.
Yeah. And you know, a good question would be how many?
And even pedestrians cross in a red.
Yes.
When it's all clear.
Yes, yeah, when it's clear. Well, even.
Usually.
Yeah. But out of 100 cars, how many actually go through? That would be a study that you could do.
Here's a study I do a lot. I do it all the time. If I'm waiting for the bus, I count how many cars go by with one person only in it. Like,
oh, very nice.
It's a huge ratio of like people at one per car. It's
just
one,
and then... And how many cars actually stop?
Normally, 3 or 4 cars go by in like red light.
Time you switch on the TV, you can bet your old boots that at some point you'll see a high-ranking copper or Tory MP calling on all who are British and free to stand up and defend law and order. It's illegal to rip off a payroll, it's illegal to hold up a train, but it's legal to rip off a million or two that comes from the labor that other folk do. To plunder the many on behalf of the few is a thing that is perfectly legal. It's illegal to kill off a landlord or to trespass upon his estate, but to charge a high rent for a slum is okay. To condemn 2 adults and 3 children to stay in a hovel that's rotten with damp and decay is a thing that is perfectly legal. If your job turns you into a zombie, it's legal to feel some despair. But don't be aggressive, that is, if you're smart, and for Christ's sake, don't upset the old apple cart. Remember, the boss has your interests at heart, and it grieves him to see you unhappy. If you fashion a bomb in the kitchen, you're guilty of breaking the law. But a bloody great nuclear plant is okay, though plutonium processing hastens the day when this tight little isle may be blasted away. Nonetheless, it is perfectly legal. It's illegal if you are a gypsy to camp by the side of the road, but it's proper and right for the rich and the great to live in a mansion and own an estate that was got from the people by pillage and rape. That's what they call a tradition. It's illegal to carve up your missus
or put poison in your old man's tea,
but poison the rivers, the seas and the skies, and poison the mind of the nation with lies. If it's done in the interests of free enterprise, then it's proper and perfectly legal. It's legal to join a trade union, and to picket is one of your rights. But don't be offensive when scabs cross the line. Be nice to the coppers and keep this in mind. To picket effectively, that is a crime, worse than if you had murdered your mother. It's legal to sing on the telly, but they make bloody sure that you don't. If you sing about racists and fascists and creeps and thieves in high places who live off the weak, and those who are selling us right up the creek, the twisters, the takers, the con men, the fakers, the whole bloody gang of exploiters.
Placed above, it makes greater things small. Placed beside, it makes small things greater. In matters that count, it always comes first. while others increase, it keeps all things the same. What is it?
What does it matter?
Number one.
The answer to the riddle is number one.
Four legs in the morning, two in the afternoon, three in the evening. What is it? My answer is human.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.